My ideas, I believe, come from the source, whatever you want to call it, God, the universe, the creator, but I feel like a messenger and sort of just a vessel. And sometimes I get the message and sometimes I don't, but I'm constantly chasing that conversation.
Welcome to the Idea Generation Podcast, a show about creative entrepreneurship. My name is Noah Callahan Bever, and each week I'll be speaking with some of the most innovative ideators in culture and trying to figure out how they make their creative decisions. This week, I'm talking to rapper and entrepreneur Russ about his journey from the bottom of the basement to the top of the charts as a fully fledged independent artist. This podcast is brought to you by the good people at Shopify. Feeling the entrepreneurial itch? Turn your passion into a business with Shopify. They've got everything you need to start, run, or grow your business. Check out shopify.com/idea to learn more. In 2014, as the internet upended how music was consumed, distributed, and monetized, a college dropout with dreams of being the biggest artist in the world had an idea. Russ, a producer, rapper, and singer, began to release one new song each week on SoundCloud, kicking off a trend that he'd continue for more than 2 years. A trend that would ultimately launch him onto the charts and a bevy of plaques onto his walls. In the ensuing half decade, that work ethic and unwavering belief in self set the foundation for indie success, a major label partnership, billions of streams, arena tours, book deals, and a healthy dose of controversy. And it all started with one idea.
So my mom and dad were born in New York, New Jersey, Italians. So they didn't move to the South till they were like 30 or something like that. So in the house, it was Northern Italians, you know, but I was in the South. So it was a cool kind of juxtaposition. You know, I lived in North Carolina for 13 years and moved to Georgia when I was going into eighth grade, so when I was 12. And we moved around at weird times. So we kind of always stuck to each other. It was very big, like family oriented.
Wild moving.
So my dad was just like job chasing and just, you know, doing that. He didn't go to college. So, but super smart, like smartest person I know is my dad, but wasn't able to go to school for various personal reasons, but he was making shit happen. So, you know, worked at a bank, worked at an advertising agency, just whatever. And we would move around, you know, so. It was, I learned kind of early on how to move with the punches. Like, my parents feel bad that they were like they've told us, like, oh, we feel bad for moving you kids around so much. But it made you guys stronger and able to adjust more so than other people. There's a lot of people I've noticed as adults who, they don't do well with change. Their whole life, they've been born and raised in one place. They've known everyone since they were in kindergarten. And you know, it's like, I've had three separate groups of like best friends. You know what I mean? Where it's like, I had best friends in Kentucky. I lived in Kentucky for a year. I had best friends in North Carolina and then moved to Atlanta. And I knew those kids for 4 or 5 years. But I was never one of those kids who was like, oh, I'm super attached to the like people at my school and people I'm around, because I was moving around at these weird times where as soon as I would get close with people, we would move. And it was like really like traumatic, honestly, when I was younger, like fourth, fifth grade or moving or whatever. And I was like crying in the driveway, like, why do we have to move? But it worked out because, like I said, in my everyday life, I feel like I kind of roll with the punches pretty well and I get over things quickly. And I move on and I'm able to kind of just keep the train moving as opposed to someone who's like never experienced change. And it's like, oh my God, they're out of milkshakes at McDonald's. What am I going to do? You know what I'm saying? It's like, I don't know. I feel pretty well equipped for like touring in different states every day or whatever, you know, whatever the case is. So
how did your parents' professional life inform your aspirations?
Their professional life? Not at all. Not really. I mean, my mom was a teacher, but then she stopped and she was just taking care of the kids. My dad was, like I said, he was at a bank And then he worked at an advertising agency. But he was always just really musical. His dad, my grandfather, Pop, who passed away, taught me how to play guitar. He was like,
oh, really?
Yeah, he was in a band with his brother, and like he was a painter and an architect. Like, so my dad's side of the family was super creative. My mom's grandmother or great grandmother would play the organ and piano at like people in the mafia's weddings and shit, for like for real. But so there was music on both sides. But they personally weren't, their professional lives personally weren't necessarily influential, because mm-hmm. It had nothing to do with music.
When Russ moved to Georgia, he developed a friendship with a gentleman who would become his longtime collaborator and business partner, Bugis. The duo dedicated their time and energy to practicing their skills as producers and rappers and developing the Diamond sound.
When I moved to Georgia, Bugis was like one of my first friends, like just in eighth grade that I met in Georgia.
And he was the MC and you were the producer at that
Correct.
Point.
Yeah. And he wasn't even rapping at first. At first, I was just making beats. This is like ninth grade, high school. I'm just making beats. And Bugis hears that I've been making beats and he's like, oh, I have friends that rap. And so Bugis is bringing those people over to my parents' house. And we have this janky setup of like a mic from that from the video game Rock Band and like fucking pantyhose as the pop filter over the wire, clothes wire hanger, and you know, and the guitar amp as a speaker in GarageBand. So like, but it was incredible and we were geeked and fucking ecstatic. But Bugis wasn't rapping yet, but naturally what happens is like people just stop, like, you know, it was a hobby and Bugis really loved it and I really loved it. So Bugis started rapping and he got a studio at his parents' house that was way more legit, and that was a wrap. So that second semester, senior year, we like, it's funny how there's certain dates that are like real, real important to us. So like January 1st, 2010 is the day Bugis got his studio equipment at his parents' house. And that's the equipment I recorded my whole career on up until Shake the Snow Globe. So like
okay.
Everything, including the second album, including right. Zoo. But yeah, so that second semester, senior year, he goes to Morehouse. I go to Valdosta, which is like 4 hours south of here, like right near Florida. And I don't, you know, we don't really have that much of a plan. I mean, we did, but Bugis was just rapping. I was producing. He was putting out like demo CDs and doing, you know, little shows around Atlanta and shit like that. But being in my dorm room, I'm just making beats and I start experimenting with like songs, like writing my own shit. I didn't have a mic or anything in the dorm. I just had my Mac, my laptop, and I would just record. I would turn the speakers down really, really low, or no, I would put headphones in and I would record just using the Max mic. So it sounded like dog shit and the songs were horrendous. Like it's so bad. I have a playlist though on my computer of like dorm room songs that no one will ever here. It's just like so bad. It's so bad. But I kind of got the bug from that. I was like, wow, this is fucking awesome. So this is 2010, fall of 2010. And I'm like, I really want to do this. And Bugis had put out a demo CD. And I was like falling more and more in love with just making music and production. And Twisted Fantasy just dropped. And like, I was just like, man, I'm doing this shit. I need to make something that gives me the feeling of Twisted Fantasy. Like,
had you contemplated any other careers, like when you know, applied to college? And like,
no, it was one of those things where music was always a hobby, and it just slowly started becoming more and more of my everyday life
mm-hmm.
to the point that, okay, let me give this a real shot. So my mom wanted me to stay in school. My dad was like, go for it. So came back home, went to like Kennesaw State for like 2 months, which is 20 minutes away. But that wasn't working either. I was sitting in lectures, like making beats, you know? And I was like, nah, I gotta really like give this shit a try. So spring break of second semester, freshman year in college, I go to California for my first time. Me, Bugis.
Oh, to shoot the music video.
Yeah. Our videographer at the time, a friend, and then another friend from high school that was out there. And, we go out to LA, Boogie Springs, we out to California for my first time. He was born in LA. And we shot his song, Cali. And I think like a couple months later, he was spamming Rob Markman on Twitter, just like talking shit. And long story short, Rob Markman ends up responding and like puts Boogis on Get in the Game when they used to do that segment.
On MTV.
Yeah. With like a different song, different video. But after that happened, I was like, we got on MTV. I'm not talking to anyone and I'm doing music full time. Fuck what y'all talking about. So after I went to LA that trip, I never went back to the classroom ever again.
After learning crucial skills like adaptability and flexibility, Russ had an idea while he was working as Boogis' producer. What if he started rapping? This idea allowed the young artist to develop a new discipline and find his sound, but there was still a long road ahead. As he released 11 projects over the course of 3 years, he struggled to get the attention of fans and the industry as he continuously refined his craft.
I hadn't made my own song yet. This is like October 2011. And I remember I was in Boogis' studio and I'm like doing a hook or something on one of his songs. And I turned around and I was in the booth. I was like, yo, should I start rapping? And he was like, absolutely. Hell yeah. And I was like, cool. Like Boogis is one of those people whose like opinions, especially with music, that I value extremely. So if Boogis told me, like, absolutely, put the battery in my back. So loop it all the way back around full circle. I end up rapping. And 2011, I put out my first project, Velvet. And then 11 projects later, got me to 2014. And then I started doing a song a week.
11 projects.
Yeah.
And
from December 2011 to November 2014.
And what is motivating you to churn out like music at that volume?
It was so... I got bit by the bug of like being an artist and making my own songs. And I was hooked and I was obsessed with it. And I'm obsessed with it now. But like at the beginning, I was like, oh my God. And when I find something that I like, I'm fully committed. So I just made a shit ton of music.
Did you feel like you were getting better as the projects went?
Yeah, I can. It's funny because there was like sessions where noticeable growth happened, like in that session on that verse that I remember vividly. Like 2012 on 5280, the first verse on Didn't I? I remember recording it at Boogie's apartment. And I remember you even hear on the song where I say, yo, Boog, I think I just figured this shit out. Because like, that was the first time where I figured out this whole rapping, singing thing, like a cool tone to kind of like a different cadence that I hadn't used yet. And then I remember on Boss, on 5280, I was doing this sort of lazy, drunkenly sort of delivery where I wasn't so, and that was cool. That was a little level up. Then I remember Vacation, the project that came out at the end of 2012, like October, where the whole rapping shit changed. I was way more relaxed, way more calm. And I was like, whoa, this is way different than like the voice and tone that I hadn't found my sound yet. I hadn't found my voice. Those were when I really started getting close to finding something that was like gonna be solid. And then 2014 with Pink Elephant at the top of the year, when I made Goodbye, which was my first song to ever do like any sort of damage, I was like, oh, okay. This is now what I think is good enough for real to blow up. And so now what the fuck is taking so long?
What was the narrative in your head as you're making these projects? Like,
I thought every single one was gonna blow up.
And how was that gonna happen in your mind?
That's what was so ridiculous. I just thought it was so good that it's just gonna blow up. And back then, you know, like Two Dope Boys, like getting on Two Dope Boys was like, I'm about to blow up. That's it. All I needed was Two Dope Boys. Cause this is it. This is in the time when I'll never forget Rory. You know Rory, yeah, right? I'll never forget when Rory came out, he was posted on every blog at the same time. Mm-hmm. And that's what made it huge because, like, granted, the music was good, but I'm saying, like, back then, that shit meant a lot. And if every blog is posting about it, oh, this is for real. So that's when I was really, like, emailing every writer at every... I emailed you a million times. You probably don't even remember. Yeah, for sure. What? So many times. You should go back and look at those. Those are probably nuts. Because I was emailing saying crazy shit. But yeah, I emailed everyone. I emailed everyone at Pigeons and Planes, at Pitchfork, at Fader, at Complex, at XXL. Everyone. Like, so, like, oh man, bro. Like hundreds of times a day. So those were like, you know, and then there were smaller blogs and shit, but I remember watching that Roy shit. I was like, if I can just get every blog to post my shit at the same time, I'm gonna be out of here.
Was there,
but like, it never happened.
Were those were those posts making any sort of material difference to, like,
the blog posts?
Yeah, the momentum.
In my head, it was like when we first got posted on Two Dope Boys, we lost our mind. We were like, what? Because we used to be on Two Dope Boys every day in high school. You know what I'm saying? Like, and just trying to get on. So, and I felt better. We felt better. So it's like, yeah, it meant something. The momentum in my life up, but I was able to be more positive because I was like, okay, shit is happening. That's a milestone back then. But yeah, I mean, I thought everything was just going to blow up and I'm glad it didn't. But I realize now that, you know, it wasn't by chance that Rory got posted on every blog. I'm sure there was a team and, like, it was coordinated at the same time. We're all going to post. You know what I'm saying? But when you're naive, you just be thinking that, nah, if it's good enough, like, everyone's just going to post it right now. It's like, no, they're not. You fucking idiot. So that never happened. But the internet world and the blog world changed relatively fast as far as, like, the dynamics and the power shift. Like, it went from, like, you know, those, like, 07, 08 to, like, 2013, 2014 was, like, I feel like the golden era of, like, when shit was blowing up on the blogs.
Blog era.
Yeah, when I would see, you know, TDE on Two Dope Boys and fucking Big Crit and Wiz and all this shit. But then, you know, like I said, I put out my last project, my 11th project, fall of 2014, and I was like, fuck, this shit is not working. This approach isn't working. But I was like, the music is good enough. And this is around the time SoundCloud was, like, becoming a thing. And I never liked SoundCloud at that time because I just didn't like how it looked. But I was like, you know what? Let me, like, study it. And I noticed that everyone's first song on their album was getting the most plays, and it would go down from there. And I was like, oh, all right. Well, instead of putting out projects, which clearly get slept on, even if you're a big artist, I would just give you all the top song every time. I would just give you one song a week. And that's kind of what hatched the plan of, like, I'm not going to not give y'all another album. I'm going to have the album on the side, but I'm going to go make 25 to 50 songs, stock them up, and give y'all one every week until I blow up.
Have you ever had a big idea but lacked the tools to implement it? Look no further than Shopify. Shopify is the brand that powers all your favorite clothing, beauty, and sneaker brands and offers the best-in-class commerce tools to allow you to sell online, in person, and on all major social platforms. Shopify fuels millions of entrepreneurs and turns ambition into action. Check out shopify.com/idea to learn more. Now back to the story.
So 2014, I did a show, my first show ever, in Tumwater, Washington.
To perform your 11 albums.
Right. 40 kids. Okay. And I had 900 followers on Twitter. I don't even think I had an Instagram yet. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, no one.
How did you get that show?
One of the kids, Tanner, who's still a fan now, we still talk. Tanner had an uncle who set the show up. But this is the crazy story. So Tanner reaches out on Twitter. Maybe I had an Instagram. I don't think I did. But he reached out on social media. And at that stage, you're hitting back every fan because there's five of them to get back to. So, like, you're like, okay. So I remember talking to him on the phone. He's like, yo, like, my uncle, like, can get, like, this venue or whatever. Like, and everyone from my high school fucks with you, you should come do a show. I'm like, hell yeah. I'm like, but like, I have no money. And so like Tanner flew me, Bugis, and my DJ out at the time. And we stayed in Tanner's house. Like, this is a high school kid with his mom. We stayed in his house. We did the show, 50 kids. It was fucking legendary. Like, you know, like it was incredible. But it's like, yeah, I had 900 followers at that point on Twitter. So no traction. However, that song I mentioned, Goodbye, that I dropped in January, that we shot a video to, I'll never forget. December 6, 2014, it hit 100,000 views, which was the first time any of my anything hit 100,000. And I was confused on where the fuck it was coming from.
What were they typically doing, like 10,000, 5,000?
Yeah, I mean, I remember my Corleone video got 7,000 in a week. And I was like, this is fucking crazy. Like, don't talk to me. I'm fucking famous. No, I will not take the trash out. Nah, but so like nothing, 10,000, 15,000, whatever. Not even that.
Are you working to support yourself during this time too?
No. So my mom made me sign a contract that said, if you're not supporting yourself by this age, then you have to either go back to school or get a job. So I was...
Do you still have that contract?
I wish I... She might still have it. She probably definitely still has it. But I did not... My job was my TuneCore that was making $10 a month and then like 30 and then 100 and 200. So, you know, it was enough to like put gas in my car and like split McDoubles with Bugis and buy... Sutter Home wine.
your affinity for the small bottles?
Yeah, we were those people. No, but yeah, so the reason why I remember December 6th is because that was the date of our like diamond show. Like we used to go book the Masquerade, the bottom level of the Masquerade in Atlanta.
Okay. Yep.
And like throw our own shows where two people would come to them. So... December 6th was like that date. And it was like, it might as well have been Madison Square Garden. Like how amped we were about it. And like four people showed up and we were still so turnt. And
how was your show at this point?
I mean, we killed that shit.
Were you practicing? Like
so much. Like took it so serious. Oh man. God, it's just so lame, but it's like so incredible. Because I remember being in Boogus's basement and like me and Boogus would be like rehearsing, like, all right, now you walk over, hands up, and it's just like, go to the show, there's four people. But it's like, that's the type of delusional confidence you need, you know? Doubt didn't even exist back then. Doubt exists more so now, which is crazy. But, yeah, so December 6th, the day of the show, Goodbye hit 100,000 views. So I was like, okay, something's happening. Come to find out, it was because it somehow went viral in the Middle East. And that's what started my Middle East fan base, which I ended up doubling down on.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, so end of 2014, I come up with the idea of Song a Week. So I start doing a song a week. And like I said, Goodbye was the first one that was kind of doing damage. I'm getting hit up by all these Middle Eastern people.
Do you know how it went viral?
Or? No clue. Because it's viral. I mean, it got 100,000 views in 9 months. So it's like...
Okay, but it was getting
traction, yeah. And I'm not even sure. But when I look back, a lot of countries, really, that's how they consumed music was YouTube. It wasn't SoundCloud. And Spotify was not anything in 2014. Apple Music didn't even drop till 2015.
Yep.
So, you know, YouTube and SoundCloud were kind of it. So 2015 is going, I'm putting out a song a week and I have all the social medias now. I have Snapchat, I have Instagram. And I'm noticing on my Snapchat, so many Middle Eastern people hitting me up, like sending me goodbye. I'm like, oh shit, this is crazy. There was like a lot of women and da da da. And I was like, okay, like, I'm going to just talk about this then in one of my songs. So on my song, Too Many, I mentioned them, Saudi Arabia. I mentioned women from Saudi Arabia and it went nuts. And I was like, oh, this is okay. I'm going to keep going with this because they fuck with me. I fuck with y'all. So then I mentioned them again on Pull the Trigger.
So when you say go nuts, you just, like, what?
They love that. I mean, like, they were even more hardcore fans now. And that song started going through the roof. So, like, in the span, I would say, of, like, a month, I put out What They Want, Too Many, and Pull the Trigger. And, you know.
What was going on with you creatively that?
I was in such a fucking free bag, bro. There was no outside chatter. I wasn't famous. I didn't have money like that. You know, I had 2015, I was making $500 a month, you know, on average until the end of the year. But it's like, I was just at like my purest level of expression because it was like, it was blowing up. It was bubbling. And so I don't know. I was just like, it was an energy, you know, it was a momentum. But yeah, so, you know, mentioning them in the songs, that really helped me a lot grow my connection with that audience. And I'll forever fuck with them because they were showing love for no reason. Like, it's not like Goodbye mentioned anything about Middle East, you know? So yeah, so there was like little spikes like that, man, that would happen along the way that kind of increased my visibility. And, you know, I made a song with a kid from Belgium and went out to Belgium and did a 300-person sold out show. And since then, Belgium has always been one of my biggest markets, you know? So I even take that into consideration now. Like, I got a song with a Brazilian artist out, on the way. Like, you know, I'm trying to do songs with people from any country that's dope because I know from 2014 and 2015, when I go, like, connect with an artist from there and give y'all music that y'all can fuck with, it's a wrap.
After laying the groundwork for his rap style and his fan base, Russ was ready to take things to the next level. While he began to make some industry inroads, connecting with his now manager Milan Ackerman and renowned music agent Kara Lewis, his analytical approach would fuel his constant growth and lead to a one-of-a-kind record deal.
You still have no sort of inroads or connections within
None. The
sort of rap world.
So 2015 is when Milan emailed me, right? Okay. 2015 is when, like, people start reaching out.
How were they finding you, you think?
I want to say Two Dope Boys, to be honest.
Okay, because they're still posting. Maybe point, not. They're not posting.
They're posting everything. Yeah, okay. Shake was posting everything. So was DJ Booth. So yeah, but it was like very just feeler sort of reach outs. It wasn't really that serious. Like, I met up with Brian Johnson from Atlantic in New York at a restaurant. Dame from Funk Volume actually flew me out to, like, open up for Dizzy Wright in Denver. And it was like 1,100 people sold out. And I remember being like, this 1,100 people feels like 10,000. This is fucking scary. What? This is crazy. But so little spikes like that were happening. Then 2015, when things start to compound, and, you know, 7,000 followers and things are starting to get plays, and Milan reaches out and we start talking. He flies me up to Toronto. Never been to Canada. First night we met, takes me to a studio that I ended up making a song that made There's Really a Wolf, my first album. So, you know, things start happening like that. But I remember telling Milan at that time, because I had been studying the game. And at that time, Peter Schwartz and, you know, Kara Lewis were like top booking agents. And so I was like, I need a booking agent. I knew I needed a booking agent because I was like, I want to go on the road. I want to go on tour. And so I told Milan, I was like, I don't want to talk until you get me Kara Lewis. And, like, long story short, he ends up getting me a meeting with Kara Lewis, gets me Kara Lewis. And so that was like September 1st, 2015. There's so many like little things in the story. Like, that was crazy because Johnny Shipes had flew me up September 2015 to meet with, like, him and kick it with him and Cinematic and shit. So, like, things were just starting to happen, you know? But this is after, you know, 50 weeks in a row of putting out music. And this is What They Want was out. It wasn't obviously going nuts, but, like, you know, songs that are now platinum were out.
What was going on with Bugis's career?
Boogus was still making music. We were still making music. He was still putting out projects. But I think in that era, 2016, I feel, or 2015, I think he was taking time off to just record and kind of figure out what his next plan was as far as how he wanted to put out the music. But he was there every step of the way. But yeah, so 2015, things started happening, et cetera. And yeah, I mean, you know, a combination of persistence and great music and leaning into the fact that, like, women liked when I would lip sync my R&B songs in the studio that I just made. You know what I'm saying? So, like, I would post those videos on Twitter and they would do, like, really well considering the followers I had. But yeah, I mean, I put out, people always are like, they try and poke holes in the shit and like they don't understand. But at the end of the day, it comes down to the music. You got to think in 2015, I put out What They Want, Too Many, Pull the Trigger, Losing Control, and Do Myself. Those songs alone have sold 12 million records just in America, you know? So it's like, those were really great songs that came out and it compounded. And then little things, like I said, little things would happen. I remember in December of 2015, this YouTuber, Andrea Roussette, posted Losing Control on her story. And that got a bunch of people involved. So I remember all these little spikes. You know what I'm saying? There's little spikes that happen along the way that are big spikes. But like, people might look at them as little moments. But like, no, when this person posted it, it did this. And then when this person, and then it went this.
But none of them were like,
I didn't know anyone.
It wasn't like a sea change. It was like lots of small wins.
Lots of small wins. It was like a lot of small compounded victories that ended up exploding into, you know, a bigger thing.
What's the moment that you think you felt like everything started to change? Was there like a tipping point?
It was like slowly, slowly, slowly tipping. That was the thing.
Okay.
You know? And yeah, I mean, getting with Kara, that was a big thing. The songs finally started to take off. I remember being like, where are all these streams coming from for What They Want? At that time, it was like really big on Instagram, like sports highlights and songs being in the back of sports highlights on Instagram.
Okay.
And I remember What They Want was in everything. And I was like, damn, what the fuck? This is where it's coming from. Because I used to really try and figure out like where the stream's coming from so maybe I can duplicate and know how to, you know, target the shit. But so What They Want was just organically getting posted like in random sports highlights. I was like, okay, this is sick. So that, you know, shit like that was happening.
And so you guys aren't doing anything to try to like juice this?
We did a digital marketing thing for What They Want and Losing Control on Facebook. We did a Facebook like ad spend with one of the people that Milan had worked with. Cause like posting the native video on Facebook at the time was like, they would go crazy. I had posted like a freestyle from DJ Booth on Facebook and it went like nuts or something. And I was like, what the fuck? So we did Losing Control and What They Want. We did just a native video on my Facebook
page. But the views were real. They weren't like...
No, the views were real.
It was real people.
It was just back when like Facebook videos would go crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
And so those two videos went nuts on Facebook. And that like, they started to blow up. Once I put out the videos for What They Want to Losing Control, yeah, that's what sent them to the roof. And so I remember Kara got me a show opening for Bryson Tiller in 2015. And... 2016. I mean, so 2016 is when we put the videos out, the Facebook open for Bryson Tiller. Things are happening. What They Want, Losing Control, blowing up and going fucking crazy.
Where are your delusions of grandeur at this point? Like, how are you feeling about?
I'm like, I fucking knew it. I fucking told y'all. Y'all fucks, I told y'all. So Kara gets me my international booking agent. Cause she was like, I remember being at South by Southwest and she was like, you need to get an international booking agent. I'll connect you with my people. I was like, cool. Cause a lot of my fans were overseas. You know what I mean? So my first tour ever was a European tour.
Really?
Yeah. So I did like Manchester, 150 kids at the Ruby. I'll never forget. London, 300 kids sold out. Belgium, 1,100, biggest show on tour. Cause I planted the seeds.
Paris. Oh, you done the record with the dude.
Exactly. Paris, 300 kids sold out. Berlin, 250 kids. Cologne, 250 kids. So it was lit. Like, that was my first tour. We were taking trains and broke even on tour, but it was incredible. Came back from that tour. Now things are like, things are happening. Things are blowing up. The music has permeated. The videos are going crazy. Shit is getting lit, right? So come back from that, and I'm reading my analytics. I used to send Kara like my SoundCloud analytics. I'm like, look, these are my top 10 cities. Let me just go to the top 10. So that's what I did. And everything was fucking sold out. It was crazy. And from there, that's when labels really started calling, started taking meetings. So 2016, I partnered with Columbia. And then, yeah, man, that shit was a wrap. 2017, put out the album. Crazy.
When you did the deal with Columbia, were you 100% on board?
I wanted radio.
Okay.
And this was still the time, like, Spotify wasn't really, like, what Spotify is today. It wasn't, like, this powerhouse that... It just wasn't a thing at the front of my brain. Like, oh, all you need to do is just get on this playlist. It wasn't like that. And Apple Music just came out.
Yeah.
So I'm still... It's that transition from blog to streaming era. So, like... I'm looking around the game and I'm like, well, everyone's on radio and everyone on radio has a label and I want to be the biggest artist in the world. So I got to level the playing field. So I was like, let me build up the leverage. Let me let me partner with the label. The other randomly organic thing that happened, April 2016, Kylie Jenner posted fucking Losing Control or Pull the Trigger or both. She posted Pull the Trigger like on her IG feed. And then posted Losing Control as well. This is the same time Khalid is blowing up.
Yeah.
And I remember talking with Khalid when Khalid was like graduating high school and he's talking like, we blew up at the same time because she posted Location, like the same time she posted Losing Control. So we both were like, yo, like this is fucking crazy.
How was Kylie Jenner?
No clue. Okay. So, I mean, but this is how shit is all the way nuts, right? This is how much I pay attention. The Andrea Russet girl, the YouTuber, if I'm not mistaken, I could be completely wrong with this, but I'm pretty sure this is what it was. She was in the YouTuber LA community.
Yep.
She had posted Losing Control 2014, bottom of the year, 2015, bottom of the year, 2015, December. She friends with a guy named, I think Sammy Wilkinson was his name. He was cool with Stas, one of Kylie's friends. Stas, boom, 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 boom. And I remember Sammy.
Song just worked through this friend circle.
I do, because when I went to the studio with Sammy, one of my first times in LA for like music, and I'm just like hanging out. And I remember him saying, like, yo, watch, Kylie's gonna post it, it's gonna go crazy, because Stas was posting it. And so I only say the names just because it's like, just to let people know, like, shit is as organic as word of mouth. Like, I don't know these people. I didn't know them and I still don't know them. But it's like, that's how it happens. Is that this one person tells this one person tells this one person and it spreads. So then, yeah, Kylie posted that. She posted Location by Khalid. And that was when, like, people forget, man, Kylie was like breaking records out here, like for real. You know what I mean? But yeah, that's man.
Have you ever spoken to her about this?
No. No.
It's amazing.
After spending years independently developing his style, growing his fan base, and expanding his network, Russ leveled up by negotiating a unique deal with Columbia Records before releasing his debut album, There's Really a Wolf.
You want to be on radio?
Yeah.
So what is the deal like from Columbia?
The deal was a really good deal. Profit split deal, which was like rare at the time. Most new artists, it's a royalty rate deal. Keep my masters. They don't have my publishing. It's not 360. They don't touch my merch. Full creative control. I can do whatever I want, like make whatever I want. And it just made sense. You know, it was time to like level up. And at that time, that's what a level up looked like. Getting a deal was still like, oh, you're on, like, yeah, you made it, you know? So it just made sense. It was the right time.
But you were still allowed to put out records on the side?
Yes and no. Technically, no.
Okay.
But the A&R there fucked with me heavy, who was like my guy. And he would kind of like turn the other cheek and tell the rest of the company, like, relax. And so I was still like putting shit out on TuneCore, like being signed, which is crazy.
Interesting. Well, and it felt like, I mean, in
which
that,
does not happen, especially yeah. when they go platinum. It's like you're signed. So insane.
So you're still cranking records out on your own,
mm-hmm.
but you're in the major label system.
Yeah.
What was that experience like?
It was cool. I mean, we had like this understood agreement that everything before the debut album was me. You know what I mean? They were going to let me just keep on rocking out on TuneCore. But it was cool. I mean, doing the debut album was sort of like the plot point one. You know what I mean? It was like, I'm here for real. And it was so successful. The touring was crazy. Shit went through the roof, man. Like that debut album is like one of the most commercially successful debut albums ever. Like when you go look at, like, it's crazy, bro.
How many times platinum is it?
It's about to be, it's probably double by the time this, yeah, it's like at 1.9 something, but, you know, 7 songs on there with a plaque. One of them is 5 times platinum. One of them is 4 times platinum, but, you know, and several others about to go gold. I produced it, obviously did the whole thing. Like that shit is crazy. That shit is a classic by default, just for what it stands for. You don't even have to like the music or whatever, but what it represents is sheer, pure DIY-ness, you know, and it's never been done before, so.
Did you feel like when you put out this debut, did this like scratch every itch for you, all of your delusions? Was this them realized, or was there still stuff left on the table that you felt like, was the chip still there on your shoulder?
Yeah, because I was like, in my head when I was 17, I was like, my debut album's gonna come out and I'm gonna do 600,000 week one. It did 49. I was like, what the fuck? But it went platinum within a year.
So say, like, when you got those numbers, because that, like you said, this was the beginning of streaming and it was like a very weird time. All the
super weird.
The numbers super were weird. Kind of funky for everybody.
Yeah.
You get that first week numbers. Like, what were you, how did you process that?
I wasn't fucking with it. I was like, this is whack, but I just accepted it.
Your fault or Columbia's fault or just the sort of nature of the game?
I think I thought it was, I probably thought it was Columbia's fault, but like now it's obviously was just the nature of where, what it was, you know what I mean? But also that first week number is really, really, really misleading. And I hate the fact that we still care about the first week number so much, because when people in the world need to understand, when you see a first week sales number get posted, that is literally just America. And coming from someone whose first tour was overseas, that's not even accurate. I didn't do 49,000 week one. I did that in America. There's a million fucking countries in the world. Like, you know what I'm saying? I did way more streams than that. That's just my streams in America. So it didn't make sense to me because I was like, this is just some bullshit. Like, I'm popping in Brazil. I'm popping in Portugal. I'm popping in Belgium. Like, I'm popping in the Middle East. Like, where are those numbers at? Give me the worldwide numbers. I want to see worldwide week one numbers. I don't subscribe to first week numbers anymore because it's American only. It's not real. Even Losing Control is 5 times platinum in America. You feel me?
Yeah.
Worldwide, diamond. You know, so it's like, but it was cool. It taught me that week 52 matters more than week one, because I ended up going platinum anyway within a year, under a year. So
to that point, you know, I do think in the streaming era, there is for many, if not most artists, a sort of disposableness. Projects come and go.
Yeah.
You know, so-and-so drops a record, 2 weeks later, it's like, no one even remembers.
Yeah.
You've managed to have these songs that live for 18 months, 24 months.
Yeah.
And just continue to rack up. And they might not ever be number one smashes.
Right.
But they just cruise at 60.
That cruising altitude of just, yeah.
To what do you attribute that? And is that by design?
Yeah, I think a little bit of it is by design, because I never wanted microwave music. I didn't want quick, like, here for 2 months and gone. I always looked up to and idolized, like, artists who made timeless stuff, Kanye's and J. Cole's and Nipsey's, Drake's, Jay-Z's, Kendrick's, you know, Cudi, all sorts of stuff. So I'm like, I never wanted, and I never made music with the intention of doing very short-lived stuff. So it's definitely intentional, but at the same time, it's the messages. You know, I was never big on like clout chasing certain topics or, you know, I don't know. I just made songs about my real life and I made my sound and my music. I didn't go hop on the Lex Luger beat or go hop on this. Not that I could have even gotten a Lex Luger beat. Shout out to Lex Luger. But I was making my shit. I made my sound. And I think by doing that, by default, I contributed something to the world that didn't exist before I was doing it, which is me. And my fans can't get me from anywhere else. And when you do that, when you give your true self as an artist to the world, you live forever because we can't get you from anywhere else. So when we want you, we have to listen to you. So I think my music has just lived and will continue to live this long because you can't get it from anywhere else. And it's real messages. I'm talking about manifesting. I'm talking about self-belief. There's a reason why I was able to write a self-help book where all the chapters are song titles. Snoop not catching his first number one till his sixth or seventh album or whatever, that shit is inspiring as fuck to me. Like Nas not winning a Grammy until now. You know what I'm saying? It's inspiring because it's like, I don't want to just be the biggest thing in the world right when I come out. The pendulum swings. It's the law of rhythm. You feel me? It's like, it's going to go the other way. It has to. It's the law of rhythm. So the artists who come out and they're hot as shit and everything is going right for you, the pendulum swings. It does. So that just teaches you to be grateful when it's swinging your way and have perspective when it's not, to understand that this also passes and this moment will be great again.
The pendulum did indeed swing. Just as Russ's career took off and his dreams of stardom came to fruition, he was faced with a new set of challenges. He titled his 2018 album Zoo because that's what his life had turned into. By the time he released his third album, 2020's Shake the Snow Globe, he began feeling the constraints of the major label system. But first, the people's champ had to learn how to deal with the abundance of hate he was receiving on social media after wearing a t-shirt that read, "How much Zans and Leans do you have to do before you realize you're a fucking loser?"
What is inspiring the hate?
The t-shirt of the Xanax and the lean and the, you know, shit like that. The Everyday Struggle interview with Nadeska. Those things like...
I remember that one.
Yeah, it's like, so the pendulum started to swing and...
When you wore the t-shirt, did you ever consider that there were going to be people that took that as like a shot across the bow?
No, I really didn't. Because I know who I was talking to white kids who are doing Xanax and lean for no reason other than to look cool. That's like all who I was talking to. Then people who like deal with PTSD and like mental health and all these things or whatever were coming out and like, I'm like, I'm not talking about y'all. Like, whatever. Stand by what I said. Like, whatever. You know what I mean? Like, y'all have called me losers too. Like, get over it. You know what I mean?
What was that like though? Emotionally for you to go from being kind of the people's champ that's like this underdog success story to now all of a sudden
get him the fuck out of here.
Fuck Russ is
trending on Twitter. Bro, it was fucking that was tough. My confidence in my faith had not been tested up until that point, you know, and it was tough to fuck with my head a lot. I'm also very confrontational. I'm not like, I was never the one in school. If you were making fun of me, I would run away and cry. I would just make fun of you back. Like, you know, I have a temper and I'm confrontational. And so it didn't do well for my mental health because I was just like, y'all got me fucked up. Fuck y'all. Like, and people just saying any sort of like, just talking crazy about me. Like, it pissed me off because I was like, they're just, the principle of it pissed me off because I'm like, you're saying it as if you're so sure nothing could ever happen to you. And that's what infuriated me. I'm like, you're arrogant as fuck. Like, you think you're invincible because of what? I got off social media at the end of 2018. It got to a pretty dark place. I thought I was going to die. And I, not that I was going to do it, but I remember calling my mom, like, I'm going to die. I was like bawling my eyes. I was like, I know, like, I can feel it. It felt like it was like at the light around the corner. Like, that's how heavy and just dark everything felt. And it was fucked up. It was like, that's the year I made the Forbes list and sold out Staples Center. So that's like a sick sense of humor from God. You know what I mean? But yeah, so I got off social media for like a month and a half. And it helped a lot. It helped a lot. But I felt like a bitch because I was like, this isn't tough. You just ran away from it. I need to be able to be on social media, see it, and not give a fuck. So I got back on after a month and a half. And
have you gotten to that place?
Yeah, for the most part. It's like, because I've been completely dragged where, like, if someone's hating on me on Twitter, I'm like, this is nothing. I've seen much worse. That's it. 20 retweets. That's your best.
So how did you go about bouncing back from that moment?
Gratitude. Yeah, I was very focused on what was, like, shit and the negative. And I wasn't focused on the highs. And it's hard because negativity is much louder. It stands out more, you know, especially when all you're looking for is positivity and, like, the negative thing is like, what the fuck is this doing here? And so you hyper-focus on it. And I had to just, like, tap back into gratitude and just, it's everyday battle, you know what I mean? But just, like, being grateful for this moment. And once again, like, when you first get on and everything is going in your favor, you don't understand that. Oh, I didn't understand. I learned as I went that you really need to be grateful because the pendulum swings, you know? It's just, like I said, it's the law of rhythm. Like, everything's going great. Soak up every second of that moment because it's not always like that. You're not always in that hot space where everything's going right. So you're going to experience the lows too. Everyone does. So just being grateful. And then when the lows come, be grateful and have awareness and perspective that, okay, this will pass and it's going to swing again. When it swings again, I'll be so grateful. You know, I'm going to make sure I soak it all up. So
how did you feel about the reception to the third record?
The reception wasn't like, the third album is fire. The third album is fire. I feel like the reception was okay. But I feel like my albums are really, really indicative of the title, sometimes more so than I realize until afterwards. Like, I dropped an album called Shake the Snow Globe that I came up with that title when I was with all my friends in Morocco. We're smoking Moroccan hash. And, like, we're just having these conversations. And I'm like, yeah, I just have to reset. I just have to shake the snow globe. I was like, oh, fuck. That's the title. Because I was talking about needing to reset from, like, the hate and the bullshit. So drop an album called Shake the Snow Globe at the top of 2020, which is me basically, like, shaking off the cobwebs and shaking off the hate, you know? It's about to go gold in a couple of weeks, so it went well.
Okay. But, like, and that was the end of your relationship with Columbia?
The deluxe was.
Okay.
Yeah.
How does that work out?
So I had one more album with them, but we just agreed to, like, mutually go our separate ways.
Okay.
And I was like, I'll give you all the deluxe. And, you know, I bought myself out too, technically. It just wasn't working. And it wasn't like, it was becoming too much of a battle.
How so?
Just differences in strategies. And also, I just got to that point, like we were talking about earlier, where I was like, I can really run all this myself.
Is your ambition to run, you know, an operation that is bigger than one artist?
Yeah, so me and Boogis finally this year are starting the label, Diamond. So, okay. Yeah, it's exciting, man, because it's, like, obviously been something we've talked about, and it's always kind of been right there in our peripheral, and it's that time, you know?
Do you have a, like, specific vision for the label?
Yeah, we definitely do, for sure.
What is that?
Longevity acts. So people who are, like, they're going to be here, you know? And like I said, Diamond stands for Do It Everyday Music or Nothing. It's got to be people who really love music, not, like, oh, I was doing this for a check. Mm-hmm. I don't want any of that. You know, I want people who are hungry. So the people that I'm assigned are like obviously super talented, but like they're going to be around forever because they're hungry about music. So
how do you manage to sort of switch hats between business entrepreneur Russ and unbridled creative Russ?
It's tough because there's no office. There's no, like, I wake up in the morning, go to the office and be business and come home and be studio. It's just like a clusterfuck of like, I'll be walking around my house writing a song, but then get a call from my business manager and it's like, and then I have to hang up and be like, wow, you know what I mean? It's like, I don't know. It's just, it's a big fucking mess, but I love it. It's organized chaos.
It's not hard to find the focus. Sometimes there have been times where it was hard to find the hunger. And people need to understand that. I don't care who you are and what you say you were doing it for. When you sort of, when you make your dreams come true, there's a certain level of hunger that goes away. You know, just because it's like beforehand you were striving after this thing. And then you get it. And obviously it naturally goes away. But then what I had to tap back into, I reread The Alchemist by Paulo Coelho, and I had to tap back into the idea and the reality of that this is a journey and the pendulum swings at all times. And this is just part of the journey. This is not the end. This isn't the destination. And so now I feel like I'm hungrier than ever. And I always remained hungry, but I had a little lapse. But I always remained hungry because I love making music. So what keeps me hungry is the idea that I can make something tonight that's better than yesterday. But, you know, you gotta check yourself. You gotta catch yourself. When you get the life and everything and you get comfortable, like, you gotta check yourself and be like, hold on, like, the fuck? If this was 6 years ago, I'd be in the studio every day making a song. And I think what was stopping me from doing that, when there would be days where I wouldn't even come down to the studio, I was like, I'm my ego's in the way. Like the mask of who I am to the public got in the way of what my spirit like actually needs, which is to make music.
What is success?
God, my answer changes for this every time I get asked, like, what is your definition of success? I usually say peace of mind. I think it's being content. So peace, I would say, is success.
After our conversation, Russ gave me a tour of his 7-bedroom mansion in Georgia. He showed off his basketball court, his $15,000 salt room, and all the plaques on his walls. I asked him what the plaques meant to him.
They just confirm that my decision-making skills and my ideas are awesome.
Thanks for tuning in to our first episode of the Idea Generation podcast featuring Russ. We hope this episode brought you some insights on how to best elevate your career as an independent artist and a young creative. Remember, data is your friend. And thanks to our partners at Shopify for making this all happen. Check out their services at shopify.com/idea.